You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
And welcome, everybody, as you always are, to the couch here. I'm Dr. Michelle Cohen, and as usual, I have an amazing guest. This is someone who you are going to learn a lot from today, especially about the concept, the processes of grieving and, you know, dealing with profound loss. Let's bring him on right now. There he is, Colin Campbell. Thanks so much for being here with me on the couch.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so honored.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, we're going to be talking about Colin's book, and it's one of the best. Let me just jump right out here to say this. One of the best books on coping with profound loss, grief, and continuing on with your life, and how to just get through life and manage. Here it is, right there. I'm going to put the other side there. There you are. It's called Finding the Words, and it's working through profound loss with hope and purpose. One of the best books I've read, and I've read most of them, you know, having to, you know, study the whole concept of loss and grieving and all that, and how we help patients work through those issues, as well as coping with many myself. So let me just set it up here. And by the way, to introduce you to Colin Campbell, he is a writer and director for theater and film. The short film he wrote and directed with his wife was nominated for an Academy Award. Campbell teaches screenwriting at Chapman University and theater also at California State Polytechnic University, right here in beautiful Southern California, Pomona. He has a BA from the University of Pennsylvania and an MFA from Columbia University. He's currently developing a solo performance piece entitled Grief, a One-Man Shit Show. I really want to see it. Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Good for you. By the way, this is your first book, right, Colin?
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes.
Wow. What a beautiful piece right out of the gate. I'm telling you, it's a stunning book. Let's just jump into the beginning here. Why did you choose the word words, finding the words as your title? Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It seemed like a really central issue for me in my grief, the search for words, not only for me to process my own grief, my own loss, just to literally understand it. I needed to articulate it in order to just understand it. But then also, it was a real journey to find the right words to get the help I needed from my community. So yes. I really felt like it was difficult. It was difficult emotionally to ask for that help, to correct friends I felt like they were saying things that weren't helpful.
Sure.
So it was really challenging. Both those things are challenging.
Amazing. Would you like me to set this up, or can you explain to us exactly what happened to you guys?
Sure. Yeah, I can explain. Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
I respect
that. Yeah. So I'll try and do it quickly. But my wife Gail and I were driving to the desert, Joshua Tree, with our children, 17-year-old daughter Ruby and 14-year-old son Hart. And we were driving up to Joshua Tree, just crested the hill. Some of you who know this beautiful road, Highway 62.
Yep.
And we were struck by a drunk and high driver going 40 miles above the freeway speed limit. And both of our children were killed in the back seat, Ruby and Hart. And Gail and I suffered some injuries, went to a hospital, but then were released almost prematurely so that we could actually go to another hospital, the PICU unit, to say goodbye to Hart as they took his body off of life support.
Right.
After Ruby had already died.
Right. My God. I mean, in your book, which I so appreciate, is you really address the isolation and pain that often encompasses grief and loss. You also talk about the community that is so important, and many of the rituals that you practiced. Are rituals with every religion or whatever, but these are beautiful. I've been sitting in Shiva for many years, and it's just, you know, I understand the profound loss and how important that is to have that support. One of the other things in your book, which I really appreciated, is that you suggest at the end of each chapter, action. What can we do for ourselves to help us through different aspects of grief, such as pain, guilt, things like that? And also, you suggest things that we might be able to journal and think about within ourselves. And these are so important in the process of working through our grief. So thank you for that as well.
Yeah, I think the idea of what do we do is such a central idea. I remember one point, Gail and I were coming out of a grief group, and she just doubled over in pain and just wailed.
Oh, sure.
What are we going to do? How are we going to live? And
right.
And the idea of having action, of taking action in grief, was so empowering for me, so helpful to me to do something.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. I want to talk about sitting Shiva and all that, and just a bit in the rituals and how important that support is from community. Something that we as psychologists are encouraged to say, you know, is everyone has their own grief. We all process it in our own way and all that. And we were just taught that. That's what we have to say, because it's sort of a thing where, you know, it's legitimizing their own process, whatever that is. So we think. But I don't really agree with that, as with you in your book. I think it's kind of, so can you share your, you know, disagreement with that as well?
Absolutely. And I want to say I understand exactly where it's coming from, and I support the impulse. Sure. The impulse, it's coming from the idea of validating somebody in grief. The last thing we want to hear as we're grieving, stumbling through this traumatic experience, is to hear that we're doing it wrong, right? The idea is, you know, don't judge yourself in your grief. Don't feel bad about how you're doing your grief. That's really an important message. The flip side for me was, you know, everyone grieves in their own way. Therefore, you're on your own. Good luck to you, because nobody knows how to really grieve. Nobody knows what it is. It's mysterious. Right. It's individualistic. And then I'm left feeling, well, then I have no help. I'm on my own in this journey.
Right.
And I really discovered that wasn't actually true, that there was a commonality to the struggles of other people grieving. I could learn a lot by talking to other people who are grieving and get specific things validated in me that I found helpful as I was journeying through grief.
Right.
It felt like that it wasn't as mysterious as people were making it out to be. It wasn't as individualized. All our losses are individualized. Nobody knows what my specific loss feels like, but the rituals, the actions we can take, I think can apply to anyone who is grieving.
Right. Beautifully said. You also talk about, you know, how you were raised not agnostic, atheist pretty much, right? And your wife is Jewish. And so, you know, she really wanted your children to be raised Jewish and follow all of the traditions, one of which includes sitting Shiva. And that is so important to me in my experiences in the grieving process. So can you explain how much that community helped you and what you got from that?
Yeah. So my cultural background just had no tools for grieving. I love being raised as I was raised. I love being an atheist, but I do. That's who I am. But when it came time to grieve the death of my children, I had no cultural tools. I had no traditions passed down to me. So I leaned into the Jewish traditions. And over the years, we were active members of our synagogue, and I loved the Jewish traditions and the holidays. Yes. It meant a lot to me. And I actually was central in encouraging Ruby and Hart to both be bar and bat mitzvah. It seemed important to me that they have this culture. It was quite beautiful. But prior to their deaths, my conception of grief was that you do it on your own. Mm-hmm. You go off in a corner, you feel really, really sad. And then when you feel better, you come back to your community.
Yes.
And it's reinforced by a lot of the movies and TV shows. That's what happens.
Yeah.
In a way, like the tougher the character, the more isolated they are in grief, right? They're like, don't talk to me about my pain. I'm going to handle it all by myself.
Right. That's right. That's how they're portrayed. Exactly.
Yeah. And the Jewish traditions, just blew that apart for me. And I suddenly realized, oh, no, grieving in community is what I need. It's so helpful. Obviously, there are times when I'm grieving by myself, of course. There's plenty of private rituals I talk about in the book, and journaling about my grief and being alone in my grief is important to process it. But the component of being in community seems so novel to me and so valuable. So Shiva lasts for 7 nights after the funeral. And your community comes to your house and sits with you each night for a while, a couple of hours. And you say some prayers. Right. And then most importantly, you talk about your loss. Right. You share your feelings. As a griever, you get to say whatever you want to your community. And at first I thought, that's not what I want. I want to be left alone. Hey, like, leave me alone. Right. I'm in pain. Right. Don't come to my house. Right. But then I discovered, no. It's so valuable to share, to be with community and then share my feelings. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. And what I really appreciate too is that you don't even have to share. You can sit there in silence the whole night if you want. And there's no judgment from those who come. And they wait for you and they chat among themselves. And the rabbi says wonderful prayers, but there are no expectations, which I really appreciate as well.
And the idea is that they're supposed to take all their cues off of the griever. So they're literally not supposed to say anything until they're addressed by the griever. Right. And that way they can tell if I'm in the mood to say funny stories about Ruby and Hart, they can then join in. If I'm in the mood to cry about Ruby and Hart, they can follow my lead.
Yes.
And that's so helpful to a griever to have the community follow their lead.
That really is, and there are things that people, as you mentioned, say that are just kind of, that didn't feel good at all. That didn't, and you don't have to do that. But I mean, we don't know what to say because we may have experienced our own losses or not, but we just feel that, and we just, it's awkward and sympathy cards are beautiful and wonderful and all that, but they all sort of, people don't know what to do. So this is why I loved your book, Finding the Words. Here you go, folks. That's it right there. One of the best books on managing and working through profound loss and grief with hope. So something you mentioned, was about you and your wife, and you mentioned this in the book, is that men have a different approach to grieving than women. It's a little more difficult for men, of course, as you talked about a little bit earlier. But can you sort of talk a little bit about that and how you differ from your wife in working through your grief?
First is the idea that I sort of already mentioned, the idea that we're given as men this image of a manly man takes care of his own grief, which means bottling it up and denying it ultimately, not dealing with it.
Exactly.
I'm so tough that I'm not going to deal with it.
Yeah.
And actually it's much tougher to work through, process your loss and then share it with somebody, get the help you need. That's the scarier thing to do for sure.
It sure is. Exactly.
Yeah.
So secondly, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I discovered that. I didn't know. Yeah. And then suddenly I was like, oh wait, I have this need and it sure feels scary. Just talk to people about my loss, and I'm gonna cry, and that is okay. I need to cry, and I'm not afraid of that. Now, even though it's scary, I'm gonna do it, and then it felt so helpful. And then the other side, for me at least, my experience as a man was that I didn't have as many close friends that I could get real with as my wife did. She had all these girlfriends, and they could come and talk.
Sure.
And I was like, I've been neglecting my male friendships. Mm. And I think it's, I feel like it's fairly common, men in America or maybe in the world, I don't know, that we just don't talk emotionally with a large group of buddies. At least I didn't. And I really had to activate those friendships that I had to reach out, to accept anytime another guy reached out to me and said, hey, I'm available for a walk. I said, yes. Even though I didn't want to. I wanted to stay home and be my own little bubble of pain. I forced myself because I saw how valuable it was for Gail to be talking emotionally.
Oh, beautifully said. Exactly. And speaking about Gail, your lovely wife, you guys really hung in there and had a lot of you know, stuff that you had to work through together. You know, many mm-hmm. couples, and I've experienced this in my work, fall apart after the loss mm-hmm. of a child, especially, or children. Mm-hmm. So how did you guys manage to hang in there and stay together through this?
Yeah. Well, I want to say two things. It's kind of interesting. One is there is a statistical misunderstanding about divorce after the death of a child, in that, of course, there's some couples divorce. As you said, some couples definitely struggle and fall apart. But it's not as many as people think. In other words, there's a misconception out there that most couples will divorce. And people said that to me. They said, you know, how are you and Gail doing? You know, most couples divorce. I'm like, why are you telling me this? How is that helping me? It's not true. So Compassionate Friends is this national organization of bereaved parents, grandparents, and siblings. And they've done two very large studies that show that actually the rate of divorce is not greater. It's actually less than the national average after the death of a child.
Yes.
So I don't mean to demean any couples that are
struggling. No. Yeah.
Not at all. But I do want to put that out there that many couples grow closer after a traumatic event such as the death of a child because here we are, Gail and I, we're the only ones in the world that share this loss.
Right.
We're the only people we can talk to fully about our lives with Ruby and Heart, and in a way, it can make sense that we get closer because, you know, how could we stand to lose each other after we just lost Ruby and Heart? We're already so alone, you know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Thanks for that. That sure makes a lot of sense. That's for sure.
Yeah.
You also talk about leaning into pain rather than avoiding pain and how important that is. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah. Well, I had this very powerful moment very early on, maybe 2 days after the crash. We had these large posters of Ruby and Heart. We had two of each for the funeral. A friend of ours did these big blow-ups to put on stands for the crowd of mourners to see Ruby and Heart at the funeral. And I taped them up to the walls of our living room. And then I wanted more. I just wanted to see their big, beautiful faces. So I asked for four more. So we had eight large blown up photos of Ruby and Heart's faces on our walls in our living room, like a giant shrine. And that felt good. But then one morning I came into the living room and it was so painful to see their faces. I had to look away. I was like, oh my God, it hurts. And then in that moment, I was like, what am I doing? I'm literally looking away from my own children because I'm too scared of the pain.
Right.
And I thought, I can't do that. I can never do that. I'm not going to let my fear of pain come in between me and my own children.
Beautifully said.
That was my epiphany. And so I sort of shouted out through tears. I was weeping. I'm not afraid of you. You know, I wanted Ruby and Heart spirits, whatever. Yes. I'm an atheist, of course, but I don't know. Their spirits are out there in me, in the world. I don't know.
Absolutely.
And so I just wanted them to know that I wasn't, and myself too, that I wasn't going to be scared. I was going to lean into that pain.
Yes.
And that was a real eye opener because it suddenly reframed everything. So let's say Ruby and Heart and Gail and I, we loved walking in Griffith Park.
Yes.
We loved hiking Griffith Park. So part of me didn't want to ever go back there again.
Yes. Yes.
Because of fear.
Sure.
Fear of the pain.
Sure.
But then I thought, wait a minute. I love Griffith Park. I can go to Griffith Park and think about Ruby and Heart. And I do want to go. I want to lean into that pain because I want to experience the joy.
Right.
I want to be able to think about Ruby and Heart and in our memories and the beautiful times we had. In order to do that, I have to lean into the pain.
Mm.
And ultimately, I trusted that the more I did these things, the less pain I'd feel and the more joy I'd be able to access. And I feel that really is true.
Boy, is that true. That is so true. And I know we'll talk about denial in a little bit and, you know, how we all do that, of course, with everything in life for that matter, but especially when we're dealing with, you know, loss, profound loss. And so again, what I said at the beginning of the show, I love that you have these actionable ideas, what people can do at the end of each chapter, focusing on different feelings or experiences we may have, you know, after our loss. So could you suggest to us some of the actions that we can do in order to cope with the pain and perhaps some of the journaling tools we might use?
So, you know, some of the actions that I just mentioned now is like, you think about something, you know, a friend of Rubin Hart's, for example, right? So they were kids, they were teenagers, they had all these beautiful friends who loved them and who were grieving them. And part of me doesn't want to see them because it's very painful. Yes. You know, I see Rubin Hart's dearest friends and they're growing older, and that's a painful thing. But then I think, well, wait a minute, they love Rubin Hart. They love them, they still love them. Yes. I want to be a part of that world. I want to lean into the pain. I want to go see them perform. I want to see them graduate, you know? So those are sort of actions that I can take that's leaning into the pain, but also feeling life in all of its beauty and the pain. And then journaling.
No, journaling so true.
Journaling, no, as you mentioned, I give a lot of journaling prompts. I journaled every day for the first year after the crash. And it helped me.
Yes.
And I'd never journaled before. I wasn't a journaling kind of guy. And so I discovered it was so helpful to me because, again, I was processing my loss.
Yes.
And
yes.
I wasn't, my journal entries are not interesting. They're not well written. They're not clever. They're just processing. That's not what it's about.
Exactly. That's exactly what it's about.
Mm-hmm. It's just putting out the thoughts, and by putting out the scary thoughts, that makes them less scary.
Right.
Putting out the ugly thoughts, the thoughts that I feel really uncomfortable about, mm-hmm. that makes them also less scary.
Right.
And it just allowed me to literally understand what was happening to me. And so I have a lot of journaling prompts after each chapter in case someone's stuck. You don't need my prompts.
If you're
writing, you can ignore them, but they're just there as in case you're stuck.
Right, exactly. Beautifully said. I know that you've read and understood, of course, in your process, Kubler-Ross's, you know, identification of DABDA, as I call it, the acronym, you know, the denial, bargaining, anger, depression, and then acceptance.
Yeah.
How do you feel about those stages? Are they pretty accurate for you?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think those stages have also been misunderstood and simplified. So Kubler-Ross and then David Kessler as well, building on those, have made it clear that they didn't intend them to be interpreted as stages you go through advancing progressively through your grief.
Right.
It's not a linear traveling, right? You don't do denial and then you go on to anger and then you're finished anger and then you get accepted.
Yeah.
You experience all these feelings and they're also intermeshed. So I'm never just feeling anger or rage. It's rage mixed with some guilt.
Sure it is.
Mixed with some fear. You know, it's all a complicated wash. So I feel like those stages are, I just wish they hadn't used the word stages because it makes you think.
Right.
That
it's linear.
Step stool. But the idea, so in my book, I call them issues or challenges. I felt like that's how I experienced them. So I experienced denial, again, mixed with some rage, mixed with some pain. But there were just things that I was struggling with. And then what kind of tools could I find that would help me through that?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And there are many other stages, of course, that have been added on and more that we can't even imagine, I think, because it's very hard. Stages, there I go again. But the nonlinear, you know, feelings that vary. So I think that there, you know, those, you know, we needed someone to really define and put down certain, you know, feelings that we were going to experience and acknowledge that. But we all have
valuable.
Our own. Yes, really has been. So let's talk about denial. You talk about in your book how you faced down denial. I really appreciated the way you put that and sort of rebuilt your identity through that. Can you get into that a little
absolutely.
Bit more? Yeah,
absolutely. So my first sort of lesson in confronting denial is, again, from the Jewish traditions. I find them so valuable, and I think it helps that I'm not Jewish and I'm talking about the Jewish tradition. So it opens it up to everybody.
Sure.
You don't have to be Jewish to take in these lessons because I'm not Jewish. So there you go. Yeah. At any rate, so even the burial itself, in the Jewish tradition, what happens is in this case, if the child dies, the mother and father, they literally take the first handfuls of dirt in their hands,
right,
and then drop them onto the coffin. And you hear the sound of the dirt hitting that concrete cover of the coffin. And it's a visceral sound.
It is. Yeah.
It's real. It's like drumming into your head. This is real. Then you sit down and you watch as your entire community steps forward one at a time and throws shovelfuls of dirt onto the coffin. And you literally bury your community buries your children in front of your eyes. And at first it seems like cruel. Why am I made to sit here and watch this? But on the other hand, it's beautiful because all these loving people are doing this very difficult task for them too, right?
Yes.
It's a very difficult task for them.
Yes.
They're all weeping.
It is.
And yet it helps.
Right?
It helps because it tells you it's a long journey, denial. Confronting denial. It doesn't just go away. It's so unreal.
Absolutely.
And you'll hear grieving people say, I can't believe they're gone. And they mean it literally. I cannot believe it. I can't believe it. And yet I have to, because if I want to live in the real world, Ruby and Hart are dead and gone. And so even though my brain wants to fantasize and wants to imagine they're still alive,
or wants
to take my brain back to the day before they died.
Oh yeah.
If I want to be alive, I have to come to grips with that. As you said, confront that denial.
Yes, exactly. That is the age old question. Where, how, why, what do we do? How do we handle it? What does it mean? Why us? You know, those big, huge questions. Why our children, for God's sakes, that kind of thing. So, I mean, it's all of these tools in your book are so helpful. By the way, if you just tuned in here to The Couch, I'm Dr. Michelle Cohen. My special guest today is Colin Campbell, and he's written one of the best books I have read on guilt through suffering with pain and loss and finding the words to get through losing a special someone, especially your children in your life. So the book's called Finding the Words, Working Through Profound Loss with Hope and Purpose. And it's all about different feelings that you might experience and how others sort of approach you and how you work through your own issues. And also, as I mentioned, what I really like is the journaling that you suggest we do, and also the actionable items that we can choose to do in order to help ourselves move on or process or whatever you want to call it through our grief and loss. So if you just sort of tuned in here, Colin and his wife, Gail, lost their children in a car crash. They were in the car as well. They suffered injuries, but both children were killed. And this was due to a drunk driver. This person was high and was going, 40 miles above the speed limit or so. And so what we're talking about today is how to address the isolation and pain that accompanies grief and what you're going to go through and how to deal with it. It really, really profound, you know, insight and everything into the book. So, you know, with that being said, there's other items that I want to talk about that you address. people have a hard time, I find, navigating the holidays after loss. I mean, that's really difficult with friends and family getting together, no matter what your religious belief is. How did you guys do that?
It's so emotionally complicated. The holidays, they bring up all the things you're missing, right? And not only just the holiday itself, but the preparations for the holiday.
Sure.
Because you remember all the times where you were, you know, buying presents together for the holiday or preparing for the holiday, cooking together.
Right.
And then the holiday itself, there's this giant hole, or in our case, two holes, two people missing.
Yeah.
And then after the holidays was also very challenging, because I found that I built up the holidays in the early days, such a scary thing. Like, oh God, here comes Thanksgiving. How are we going to survive Thanksgiving? And Thanksgiving passes. And then you're like, oh God, they're still gone. I struggled. I suffered. I got through the holiday, but so what? Because Ruby and Hart are still dead. And that's when I actually experienced the biggest crash oftentimes, the first year or two after the death of my children. was a post-holiday crash. But I've posed a couple of different, you know, solutions or techniques or tools that got us through holidays. But one of the most powerful ones was realizing that the rituals help us. Rituals help us process anything. So we had created several morning rituals, public morning rituals, where we invited our friends to gather and talk about Rubin Heart and share stories about Rubin Heart and take some kind of an action, you know, jumping in the ocean together, or taking a walk together, you know, whatever it is. And so when I started to look at the holidays as just another collection of rituals, that maybe we could use those too. And so a lot of times Gail and I would sort of refashion a holiday so that we could, in a way, celebrate Rubin Heart in the act of doing that holiday. And that often helped us.
Wow. Yes, absolutely. Those are some lovely suggestions. Something that I think most of the people I know in my family or patients I've talked with and myself, we experience survivor's guilt.
Yes.
I've been experiencing this for years. When I was 14, my best friend, who I went to school with, spent school with and after school with, I lived with her on the same street. We were together, and she was killed in a car crash as well. And I was 14, and I couldn't make sense of it. But I think one of the strongest, I didn't know how to grieve. I was never taught how to grieve. But I think one of the most difficult things for me was survivor's guilt, because I was so young, and I didn't talk to anyone at school. I went into this shell and this depression. I didn't know how to express it. So you say in your book, thought I'd share a little transparency there, but I mean, I understand you know, that feeling of guilt. And one of the things that you talk about is it can be useful. And you share some of those, you know, tools, activities, and also journaling tools. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So the useful part for me was I could use it as a reminder that I need to address my grief. So in a way, it was like, if I'm feeling a lot of guilt building up, maybe it's time to visit the cemetery and just allocate some time to think about Rubin Heart and to grieve. Yes. Maybe I need to just process some more pain in a big batch. Basically.
Yes, no kidding.
So I tried to look at it that way, right? Yeah. Like, if I'm starting to feel this survivor guilt, maybe it's just time to call up a friend and talk about Rubin Heart a little bit.
That
helped. That always helped.
Yeah.
And then the flip side is something that my therapist said to me, because I'm a big fan of therapy.
Oh, good.
absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
Is that guilt is a form of denial. Mm-hmm. So while I'm thinking about the night of the crash and wishing that, you know, we had never gotten in the car, we'd never driven at that exact speed. If I'd driven a little bit slower, I would have missed her. A little bit faster, I would have missed her altogether. And so many different what ifs. And when I'm trapped in that loop of what ifs, it's a painful place to be, but it's also in a way denial, because it's me trying to think about ways of keeping them alive, but I can't.
Right.
They're gone. So in a way, guilt can be you, can be me, living in the past.
Right.
And the past is over. And let's live in the present. Let's find a way to live in the present.
Exactly. And I think that's really true, because it's important to do that. You know, I talk about with a lot of my guests, you know, we're all into quantum consciousness. You know, the quantum physics is a real thing now, and it's sort of replaced a lot of old, you know, traditional physics, but you know, that is past, present, and now is everything and all that. But the reality is we're here in 3D and we're frontal lobe beings who have to deal with the constant feelings and thoughts and things that make us remember. And so it really makes a lot of sense to try and be in the now and realize in one foot in front of the other. Do the best you can. You're going to slide down the mountain. You're going to come back up. It is a process, you know, and hopefully with that process, things get a little easier for us and for others mm-hmm. who we love mm-hmm. and who are around us.
Yeah. I think what happens is we find ways of living with grief. So we're not, it's not about boxing up or finishing it or being done with it.
No.
If we love somebody, why wouldn't we miss them for the rest of our lives?
Of course
we will. Of course we're going to grieve for the rest of our lives. But how do we live with that? With the guilt and the grief, live alongside it and be in a way okay with it. And be able to hold joy and grief in the same hand. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. No, that's so true. Something else that I think a lot of people don't talk about, well, we therapists do, but I mean, is rage and anger. Yes. And especially in a situation where someone else has caused the death of our loved ones,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
whether they're, you know, murderers, which this person was, but through right. negligence or manslaughter or whatever they were.
Mm-hmm.
How did you work through and deal with your rage and your anger? That to me is so difficult.
Yeah. Well, it's not past tense. I'm still working through it.
Sure.
I'm working through all of these things.
Okay. Sure you are.
None of these grief experiences are past tense. It's all present tense for me.
True.
But I'm continuing to work through it. And I've always been kind of uncomfortable with anger personally. I feel a little out of control with it.
Yeah.
It scares me when I feel angry. I feel out of control. And right. so I don't handle my anger very well. I was sort of forced to confront it in a more direct way and try mm-hmm. and actively,
sure.
what do I do with it? What do I do with this anger? How do I manage it?
Right.
And I think everybody who's lost someone has some kind of rage of the universe because we've been robbed.
Yes.
Like literally bereaved means to be robbed.
Right. Right. It does.
And
that's
so we've been robbed of the person we love, by the universe.
Yes.
And so, what do we do with that anger? And I think that it's so important to process it, to talk about it, to write about it, to share about it, and then find ways of expressing it or exercising it that's healthy. That's not going to hurt the people around us.
Right.
Because there is that impulse. The impulse I'm gonna let these people have it. The people that are trying to help me. Right?
Oh yeah.
That's
right.
And I'm just frustrated. I'm like, you don't get it.
They don't understand.
Right. They don't understand my pain.
Yeah.
But they're trying to.
Sure they are.
I don't want to hurt them. So I gotta find healthy ways of exercising that rage.
Right. And that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And one of the most useful tools I found was actually kindness. Acting kind diffused a lot of the rage. And even if I wasn't feeling kind, if in fact, when I'm feeling particularly unkind, if I can do something kind, pretend that I'm kind, I actually start to become kind. And so you trick yourself in a way.
No, it's true.
It helps.
No, act as if and be that and try to, it makes us feel a little better. Oh, gee. And it does sort of mm-hmm. take us out of, those thoughts or that mindset for a while. It's defocusing on that which mm-hmm. is going on and showing kindness or, whatever.
And it's taking us out of our own little heads and realizing we're part of a larger world. And there are other people out there who are also struggling.
No, it's so true. Yeah. I mean, and the rage and the anger and it's okay to talk to your partner, your friends, their closest friends. It's okay to share with that person or persons, that anger. And with me, I mean, some of the things I've heard, people say, I want to find that person at their home and I'm going to get a gun. And I mean, some of the horrific plan, and it's called normal fantasy mm-hmm. about getting even with. And, I think it's really healthy to get it out and talk about it just don't follow through with some of the plans you have.
Right.
You deserve to feel and go through this, and you deserve your life. I wanted to know also, you call the final chapter in your book meaning and purpose rather than many people who write books, about dealing with loss, despair and coping with despair. So, I mean, why did you choose that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, part of me wanted to end on despair because my experience of many grief books was that it felt like too rosy, like, you know, you do these things and then you're all better. And I was thinking, I'm never going to be all better. It's going to be a process my whole life. And I don't want to be overly optimistic and cheerful in a way.
Right.
But the reality is that I am on a journey to find more meaning and purpose. My meaning and purpose was robbed from me. I lost it momentarily when Reuben Hart were killed. I thought there's no reason to live without them. I have nothing. Everything felt meaningless.
No, right. Sure.
What's my purpose in life? My children are dead. I have no reason to still be alive.
Right.
And yet I am alive. And if I want to honor Ruby and Hart, who loved life and they loved me, and they were so full of life, if I'm going to really honor them, I got to live as full a life as I can. And have them accompany me in spirit along with me on that road. And so, part of my journey is actively searching out meaning and purpose, you know, finding reasons to live and I find that most of them come back to the idea of service on some level or other.
Yes.
Doing something that's useful to other people, or other creatures in the world, or, you know, plants in the world, whatever it is, life.
Right.
Being of service to life and love.
Life and love. And that's it. It's all about giving. And there is something about profound loss also that really teaches us, you know, because we have a lot of lessons in this, teaches us about the importance of love with those who we may have differences with, or family members we may really not want to be with or not like. It really teaches us appreciation for everyone who is in our life. Yeah. You know, we don't necessarily have to deal with the people who are, you know, really horrible to us or have hurt us in the past or whatever, you know, draw boundaries and all that. But it really does give us a profound appreciation for our loved ones and makes us appreciate them more.
It made me just realize that it is all about love. That's what matters most, you know, not careers or any kind of, you know, material advancement. Losing Ruby and Hart taught me I knew it already, but it really viscerally taught me the primacy of love. This is rocking my world in a way that nothing else
right.
could possibly rock it.
Absolutely.
Therefore, love is the most important thing in the world, right?
That's
it's the most powerful.
It is.
Yeah.
That's what we have the gift of, you know, we as humans, you know, we have the love and we get to share and we get to express and we get to feel. And of course, there is, you know, the energy of love too. I mean, scientists know that we all have energies and we put it out there and that's the whole thing with sitting Shiva too. It's that energy from, say, nine people who are sitting around you, you know, and they're there to just be and love. And that's what it's about, you know, not to mention forgiving ourselves. I mean, that goes back to what could have happened, what should have, and that, you know, also goes back to the guilt. But I mean, that the part of love of forgiving ourselves and loving ourselves for having this process.
Yeah.
And patting ourselves on the back for, okay, hang in there, buddy. You're doing okay. Hang in there. That is so important, I think, as well.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Yeah.
And you've shared that as well. You know, you shared these feelings, I know, with those who are very important to you in your life, especially your wife, and, you know, how important loving ourselves is and being humble about that.
Yeah. The I want to mention that one of the authors, Megan Devine, wrote this beautiful book called It's Okay, You're Not Okay. And that was a really powerful piece of reading for me in my early grief.
Right.
Because she made this really interesting distinction, which I you know, draw upon in my book, between suffering and pain. And so the pain of loss is inevitable. If you love someone and you lose them, you're going to feel all that pain.
Of course.
All the love. It's the flip side of love.
Right.
But there's a way for us to also add suffering on top, which we don't need to do.
Yeah.
And so in the suffering category, you know, I put guilt and blaming ourselves and doing all the things that are going to make us feel bad about ourselves on top of our loss.
Yes.
So my real goal for myself and wish for other people in grief is that they're able to allow themselves to feel that healthy pain and avoid the unhealthy suffering that so often comes with loss.
Right. And I am beautifully said, Colin. I love that. You know, something else too is that fear of, and you mentioned this in your book as well, of sliding back, yikes, into despair. Oh my God, yeah. What if I slide back? Oh my God, oh my God. Wait, I'm feeling too good. No, that's not right. I shouldn't be feeling okay today. I should be feeling this way.
Yeah.
What do you have to say about, you know,
well, lots. I remember we saw two therapists. That's how much we believe in therapists. We had one of, I saw my own therapist, and then Gail and I both went to Ruby's, our daughter's therapist, who was an OCD specialist.
Good.
Dr.
Beautiful.
Grayson.
Yeah.
And that he was very helpful too. And one of the things he said to us is, you know, stop shooting all over yourself.
So don't tell yourself,
I should do that. Yeah. I should do that.
Yeah.
That's what you just said.
That's
you
right.
know, that made me think about that.
Yeah.
Like I shouldn't be feeling this way. That's not helpful. That's all suffering, right?
That's
all
right,
judgment,
exactly.
Judgment
right.
and suffering.
Right.
But the fear of backsliding was also very confusing to me in the early days, because I would feel like I'm progressing through grief. I'm coping with it. It's date that it's getting, you know, quote unquote, better and better. And then suddenly it would feel worse. And it'd be so confusing. Like,
sure.
Wait, I was working so hard to engage in my grief.
Right.
How can it now feel worse? My
right.
pain, my grief, my loss. But that's how it is. You know, you have these moments where it suddenly hits you. A wave of grief hits you out of nowhere, or maybe you see it coming, but either way, it still hits you.
Sure, of
and,
course it does.
And you feel momentarily underwater.
Right.
And I've learned to trust that that's okay, because
right.
I'm going to come back up again.
That's really true.
You know, I'm always going to come back up again. Allow myself to feel the feelings, even though they're scary, even though it's full of despair and it feels like it'll never end. It does end. And I'm going to come back, and I need to honor this wave that I'm in right now.
Right. Beautifully said. What I also love about your book is that it really does help people think about, and I don't mean to sound trite, but what are the lessons in life that I really can learn from this experience? And I think every traumatic experience we have needs to, you know, be addressed. What can I learn from this? Or how can I be a better person for others and me and the community and to serve others as well? But I think that's, you know, really a profound thing to think about. What can I learn from this horrible thing? Well, I don't have to push myself, but.
Well, people talk a lot about post-traumatic growth. So this post-traumatic stress, but there's also a potential for post-traumatic growth.
Sure.
And at first, I found the idea offensive at first, because
right.
how dare anything good come out of Ruby and Hart being murdered?
Oh,
right?
God, yeah.
No, I don't. Right. I don't want to be better.
No. Right, no. Right.
I don't
of course.
Want any, there's no silver lining here. I refuse.
Yes.
I refuse it. But the reality is that I have changed and I have grown. And
yes,
it helps to for me to acknowledge that.
Yes.
You know,
aww.
As
well,
painful as it is.
I understand. And I so appreciate you writing this book and helping us out. It's about that time. We've got to wrap up already. It's gone so fast because it's been such a great interview and you have so much wonderful advice to share with people. And I thank you.
Thank
you. So please pick up the book, people. Please, please, please check it out. Here it is.
Yes. This is and kind of a quick plug for my show in New York.
My
solo show. Yeah, so it's called Grief, a One-Man Shit Show, which you mentioned. And it opens March 29th and runs to April 16th in New York City.
Great.
And I hope people in New York City, or if you have friends in New York City, you send them to griefonemanshitshow.com.
I love it. And what is the best way that viewers and listeners can find out more about you and get your book?
Yeah, so you can go to colincampbellauthor.com. And then I'm also on Instagram, Colin Campbell Writer.
Right.
On Instagram.
Oh, I know. And I love your posts. I mean, they're wonderful, inspirational.
Oh, thank you.
and I so appreciate, I can't wait. I would love to get a little peek. I'm here on the West Coast, so I won't be able to see your show, but I want to find out more about it and turn viewers and listeners onto that as well. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Colin Campbell, for being such a great guest and sharing your wisdom with us and your story. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much.
Take good care. Bye-bye. All right, guys. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Dr. Michelle Cohen here saying take care of yourself first, and then you'll be great for others. Appreciate you watching On the Couch. Bye-bye.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.